This is lecture tape number 2 for Ancient Israel, entitled Archaeology Methods. We're going to be spending 3 short lectures on archaeology. I wish we had more time, not just because I enjoy archaeology, which is true, but because more than any other influence other than that of geography, archaeology has contributed more to our understanding of the biblical period, understanding it in its proper light, than any other field of study. Now, if we're to understand how archaeology can be used properly to make a contribution to our understanding of the Bible, we have to understand its methods, especially how they arrive at chronological dates, which will be the subject of the next lecture, and then finally, the limitations with archaeological procedures, the limitations in archaeological methods, the limitations that archaeology has intrinsic to itself that we have to keep in the backs of our minds so that when we might come into information which seems to contradict the biblical text, we can understand why that type of situation might exist. Because many times we have this knee-jerk reaction, we read something by, quote, an authority, and ergo, it is so, you know. And I'm reminded of Sportin' Life in Porgy and Bess, in the song that was one of the lead songs that he has in that production, which is, it ain't necessarily so, though I disagree with the subject matter of the song, because it goes on to say the things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. Now, I don't agree with that, but at least the title I agree with, it ain't necessarily so, just because an expert says it's so. And as we will see from using some of these articles, not this time, not next time, but the time after, in lecture number 4, that experts do not always agree, even when they're looking at the exact same evidence. And therefore, this is something that we need to keep in mind, that we don't have to be terrorized by the experts of archaeology. Okay, so getting back to today's topic, which is the methods of archaeology, how they go about their work, so we can better understand how this material has become available to us. I'd like to start with a procedural definition for archaeology, a procedural definition for archaeology. And I like to define it as the systematic, and I capitalize systematic, and you'll understand why I'm capitalizing certain letters shortly, the systematic recovery of the surviving remains. And again, I am going to capitalize the word surviving. The systematic recovery of the surviving remains of ancient civilizations. And I don't say of ancient Israel, because archaeology is interested in more than just that one particular corner of the world and more than just that nation in that part of the world. We're giving now a general procedural definition for archaeology. The systematic recovery of the surviving remains of ancient civilization. And then the analysis, and again I would capitalize analysis, and interpretation. And I would certainly capitalize that word. And if I could put it in multicolored flashing lights, I would. An interpretation of those remains in an effort to reconstruct, in an effort to reconstruct the material civilization and the values of ancient societies. So, reading it all through again, we have the systematic recovery of the surviving remains of ancient civilization. And then the analysis and interpretation of those remains in an effort to reconstruct the material civilization. And what we mean by that is what kind of houses they lived in, what kind of tools they used, what kind of weapons of war they may have used, what kind of transportation methods they had, what social class structure they had, things like that. The material civilization and the values, religion, social customs, legal matters of ancient societies. This then is a general procedural definition. Now we'll begin with the first word that I emphasize, which is the word systematic. Probably here, archaeology is its most scientific in this area and one other. It is in its most scientific mode, you might say. Because archaeology, as some who have had me in other classes have heard me say, is both a science and an art. It's a mixture. And its methods, it employs science and the essence of art. Now, when we talk about the systematic recovery part of the definition, we're dealing with the scientific aspect by and large. So intuition enters in there, too. But still, we're dealing with scientific methods. Now, in order to recover ancient remains, you have to find them. You have to find where people lived in ancient times. Otherwise, you're not going to find very much except by accident as you wander across the landscape and you pick up something accidentally. And so what the archaeologists do is look for the remains of ancient cities. Now, in the Middle East, these places where ancient cities once existed are called tells, and that can be spelled with a T-E-L or T-E-L-L, because the word appears in both Hebrew and Arabic. One version uses one L when you transliterate it into English, and the other version uses two. It's not really much of a difference which one you use. And sometimes I use one, and sometimes I use another when I'm not thinking clearly. Now, you can, this is corny, I know, always tell a tell. Especially, as in this type of view, an aerial view. We're looking at the first slide. Because it is a hill which doesn't look natural. Its contours are too regular. It just does not look natural. And I think those who have traveled to the Middle East with me on tour, you may remember that from Mount Carmel we could see the tell of Yokneam. There was no doubt that it was a tell. And that from Lachish we could look out to the north and see the tell of Marisha. Because it just sticks up there. It's so obviously not a natural hill. It comes out of nothing, first of all, and secondarily, its contours are too regular. And this gives you an idea that even when covered with vegetation, you can see it is not a natural hill. And so they have to first find a site where ancient people lived. Now, another tool, well, actually the same tool that's being used in this photograph, because we have an aerial view showing the tell. But the point is, in this case, you've got something above the ground, which is clearly visible even from ground level. This just gives you an overall view of it from the air. But there's another technique which is used, and this, of course, is aerial photography to show things that would not be visible from ground level, things that would only be visible from the air. Now, in this second slide, we're looking at the coastal plain area down near, I believe it's Ashkelon, along the in the Philistine plain. And these little things here in white, in the upper right-hand corner, those are large apartment buildings. Okay, that gives you an idea of what kind of a scale you have here. Now, what do you notice in the photograph that isn't natural? And that is, of course, all those right angles that come together. That's not natural. Something lies under those sand dunes. More than likely, at ground level, you would see these undulations, but you wouldn't notice how regular those corners were. And so this is where aerial photography is very valuable. It will pinpoint a place where there are no visible or almost no visible signs at the surface where the remains of an ancient society lie under the ground. Okay, let's take another look at an example of the work of aerial photography. This is slide number 3. This was taken in England, and I'm not sure if it's a wheat field, a rye field, or a barley field, or what. But it's some sort of agricultural field. And you see all these dark shadows running across this nice lush field filled with waving grain. Now, nothing, again, I'll remind you, appears above the surface. If you were to walk through this field, you would see nothing. You would detect nothing. This is something only visible from the air. What you see with these straight dark lines, or mostly straight, there is some curve, are the remains of an ancient Roman settlement in this area. Down in the lower right-hand part, or up to the middle, you have the remains of what appears to be almost a single large building or an enclosure wall, and then you have a street pattern, it looks like, and something else on the other side. Now, how can you see what is totally underground when you take a picture from above of this grain field? Well, the answer is made clearer by the next slide. Differential plant growth. Plants that are growing in the average normal soil have a certain lushness or fullness. Those plants that are putting down their root systems where there's a buried wall, they can't put down their roots as effectively. Therefore, the growth of those plants is stunted. And it will be stunted exactly where the wall is. So the wall has an abrupt edge, and so the grain right off the wall will suddenly be more luxuriant. You get a very sharp separation, a very sharp demarcation between the good growth and the poor growth. Now, in this particular place, for purposes of illustration, in the right hand of the slide, they've shown you unusually luxuriant growth. And the reason for that is there's some sort of an ancient refuse pit here with lots of organic material, which is providing extra nutrients for just the plants that are growing right over the refuse pit. But in the wheat field, we would not find this extra luxuriant growth. We would find the normal growth and then the stunted growth. Now, when you take this picture from the air, either just after sunrise or just before sunset, you have the advantage that the angle of the sun is such you get longer shadows than normal. And what is happening is the plants adjoining the stunted ones are overshadowing the stunted ones, you see, and creating the shadow, depending on the angle of the sun. And that's what produced those dark lines. And as I said, there'd be no way of telling from surface level that there was something under this field. But because of aerial photography, they could locate it. And indeed, a number of ancient Roman settlements in England have been located in this fashion. But most of the time, archaeologists are interested not just in finding the remains of ancient civilizations, they want to find a specific place. They just don't want to dig anything that's old, even within a certain culture, let's say in Israel. They don't want to dig just a biblical site. They like to find a particular biblical site. I mean, this is the norm. Granted, there's a lot that can be learned, and archaeologists, many of them are involved in just digging up rather anonymous sites for which there is no name found, and there's nothing in the Bible to give us a clue what ancient place this was. But they learn something of the general picture of the society, and they're happy. But many times, archaeologists particularly want to dig at a particular place. Now, how do you find the site that you particularly want? Well, the easiest way of finding it is if the name is still the same. It's still a living place and the name hasn't changed. For example, Jerusalem. If you want to excavate Jerusalem, ancient Jerusalem, you don't have much trouble. The city's still there. Part of the city even covering the ancient area. So you don't have any great difficulty. There are a number of such places which are still bearing their ancient names. Rome, Athens, Corinth. These are still living cities, still bearing the same name, unlike Volgograd, which was once Stalingrad, which was, I don't know what it was before the revolution. My knowledge of Russian geography is not that good, which have changed their names. So this is the easiest way to find the site that you're particularly interested in. Now, often places change their names. Different people, different culture, different language, change of name. But often they leave clues to what the ancient name was. For example, in Iraq, that might give you a clue as to what city it is contained under this name, though I think it's so obvious, or should be so obvious. Now, I shouldn't say that. Then if it isn't obvious, you'll feel stupid. It's obvious to me because I've gone over it so many times. There's a place, not a living city, but a site called Babil in Iraq. What ancient city is preserved in the modern Arabic name Babil? I think it's pretty obvious to most of you. Babylon. Babylon. It's not very different. Or, for example, in Israel, there is a site, with the Arabic name, it's a village now, called Mukmas. Mukmas. This was not difficult for the people to figure out what ancient biblical site this was. Now, it's not one of the very common ones, so if you don't recognize it, don't feel stupid. I mean, it appears, I think, only in one chapter, or at the most two chapters in the Bible. So if you've never heard of it, it's no great shame. But you will see readily how closely the modern Arabic name conforms to the ancient biblical name, which is Michmash. Mukmas arose out of Michmash. Very, very close. Then we have the Arabic town name, Hiba, Hiba, which is spelled with a J, J-E-B-A, which, even though you don't pronounce it as a J sound, it's pronounced differently in Arabic, but this is biblical Giba, almost identically the same sound. There are a number of others that are fairly close. For instance, Ezza is the same as biblical Gezer, one of Solomon's major fortress cities. This one is a little bit more, a little bit further off, but still very close. Bir Esseba. Bir Esseba is biblical Beersheba, or as Englishmen like to say, Beersheba. Beersheba. One that's a little further off, but was easily recognized by the scholars, was El Yib. Now, El is not part of the name. It's usually a prefix affixed to certain places and place names in Arabic. The key part of the name of El Yib is the Yib. We in English would write J-I-B. But remember, the Arabic J comes from what letter in Hebrew? What do you see the pattern? G. The G of Gezer became the J of Jezer, or as they say it, Yeza. The G of Giba became the J of Jeba, or Yeba, Yeba, Yeba. So we need to go back to the Hebrew. We need to put a G in there, and we get G-I-B. Now, is there a place that is G-I-B? No, but there's something very close to that, which is not too far north of Jerusalem, Gibeon. Not Gib, but Gibeon. And indeed, they did conduct a dig at El Yib, thinking it was biblical Gibeon, and they found very quickly confirmation of the fact that it was. Certain features they found there confirmed it, plus they actually found jar handles that had stamped on it in Hebrew the name Gibeon. So it shows you this pattern does work. Now, sometimes it doesn't deal with a transformation of the name itself. But sometimes there's something about the place which is commemorated in the new name. For instance, there is a site in the north of Israel which is called Tel El Kadi. Tel, it means hill, usually the unnatural hills that dot the landscape. Kadi is the Arabic word for a judge. The hill of the judge. Well, what ancient tribe should we associate that with? Blank shall judge his people. Dan shall judge his people. And indeed, this is the site of Tel Dan. This is the ancient city of Dan in the north of Israel. But you see, the essence of Dan as a judge It's even related to the Hebrew word din, which means judgment, was preserved in the Arabic place name. Now, this one might be a little less easy. Khan el Jalil. I think I've... Chilil. Yil. Khan el Yil. Now, it's something of a certain region. What region of the country? We were in historical geography yesterday, and I gave you a list of place names to identify. Which region does this look most like? Remember, the Arabic J comes from the Hebrew G. Does that give you a clue as to what place, area of the country we're dealing with? It's spelled very similarly. Some people even spell it that way on tests. Yes.
Gilead?
Good. Yeah, I could see how you could get that out of it, but it isn't Gilead, though. It's something that doesn't have a D in it, but yet has the same other characteristics. Ben?
Galilee.
So the Arabic Yayu is Galilee. So it's Khan in the Galilee. Khan in the Galilee. Now, we pronounce it differently, but it's a city associated with Jesus. Cana. Cana, biblical Cana. And one last one that I'll give you before giving you an interesting story about this practice of preserving something of the essence of a name is Kereza. Can you think of a New Testament name that looks a lot like? Kereza. New Testament. Miriam? Chorazim. Chorazim. See, it changed a bit more than some of the others, but not so much that somebody knowing something about the two languages couldn't make an intuitive guess as to what it was. Now, there's an interesting story about how sometimes, as I said, the name is not preserved, as in Tel al-Kadi, the name Dan isn't specifically preserved in that, but the association of Dan with judgment was preserved in the name. In the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, there was an adventurous Englishman who was passionately interested in ancient things. And he wanted to go to the Middle East and dig up things. He came from good family, but he didn't have a whole lot of money, as was often the case. Had the breeding without the money. And so he couldn't afford to just go out to the East and run around and have a good time on nothing. So he did the next best thing. He became an official in the British Foreign Service. And he managed with his family connections to get a post in Iraq. And that gave him a lot of time in between his official duties, which were not too onerous, to go running around looking at ancient sites. But he particularly wanted to find one particular ancient site, one ancient city, which all of his contemporaries told him, you're crazy, the thing never existed. It's a figment of the imagination of these Hebrew writers. This place never existed. But he was convinced it did exist. And so he was going to find it. And he was going about the landscape, and he'd ask the local people, what's the name of this big mound, what's the name of this big mound, and so on. Because he knew it was a big city, so it should have left a big mound. And he found a very big mound, but in one particular place. But after finding out the local name, he says, nah, doesn't have any connection with the ancient name. It can't be the place. And he was about to leave when he noticed nearby a small mound. And just for the sake of conversation with the people, he was enjoying their hospitality. He didn't want to leave abruptly. You never do in the Arab world. It would be very offensive, even more than in our society. It's one of the differences I've noticed between Israelis and, I said, the Jewish people of that area and the Arab peoples is the Jewish people who come from European backgrounds or are native-born. They tend to be very abrupt and brusque, and once they finish their purpose and discussion with you, they just drop you, and that's it. And they don't mean to slam you. It's not a deliberate attempt to be rude. It's just their way, you know. They do it to each other also all the time. That's just their way of doing things. But the Arabs, of course, still cherish this more elaborate, extended form of hospitality, and you just don't break off. So this particular man, not wanting to break off abruptly, he turned his attention to the smaller mound that was within his range of vision, and he sort of idly, without really desiring to know the answer, just to make conversation, he asked the name of that mound. And he said, oh, that one, we call that locally the mound of the prophet Yunus. Nebi Yunus. Nebi in Arabic is like the Navi, or Nabi in Hebrew means prophet. The mound of the prophet Yunus. And immediately the chills went down his spine. Because what would you do with Yunus to bring it into Hebrew? Well, just like the J in Arabic is really equivalent to the G sound in Hebrew, the Y sound in Arabic is frequently identical to the J sound in English. Because there is no J sound in Hebrew. It's Y in Hebrew also. For instance, we don't say, in Hebrew you don't say Jeremiah. It's Jeremiah. Yera. You see, with the Y sound. So, Yunus was what? The Y, RJ, take that Y into our English language as a J. You have an N in it. It's a short name. It's a prophet. Who is it?
Jonah.
And that's why the chills went down his spine, because he was looking particularly for the city of Nineveh. And here, right by this big mound, was a little mound that by local tradition they called the mound of the prophet Jonah. Maybe then it meant the big one was Nineveh. You know, remember Jonah when he finished his mission, he went outside the city and sat down a short distance away and waited for God to destroy it, hopefully, at least in his mind, and God taught him a few lessons, which he may not have ever learned. We don't know, the book ends rather abruptly. We can't tell what his attitude was at the end of the book. But he got excited and he got a permit and he began working, and sure enough, it was Nineveh. The large mound was Nineveh. And he is the one, more than anybody else, who helped to establish the fact that the Assyrians really existed. And they weren't just figments of the imagination of the biblical writers. So there is another example. Now, we call these names that are similar to ancient names toponyms. Toponyms. And as I say, they are a good indication of what the ancient name was. Now, they're not always reliable. Sometimes a nearby place will pick up the name of the ancient one, but it's a nearby place, it's not the actual site. For instance, they found a mound at in the southwest of the country called Tel Lachish. Oh, that's Lachish, biblical Lachish. But it wasn't. There was another tell nearby that was biblical Lachish. You see, so sometimes these names move around. And there's a big dispute right now between scholars, at least on one, most are not really involved, but there's one who's very courageously carrying the torch for the ideal that ancient Bethel has yet to be found, rather excavated. He thinks he knows where it is, but it's not where most people think, because of this tendency sometimes with toponyms to move. Okay, so we have two methods already. We have place names that haven't changed, and we have toponyms. A third way that you can find a site, if it's the particular one you're looking for, is because some ancient document gives you a general geographical description of where to find the place. You have general geographical data, maybe even specific geographical data, in terms that it's located north of such and such, on the east side of the highway, as one goes from A to B. Now, I'm not making that up. I'm just paraphrasing a scripture. It describes the location of ancient Shiloh exactly that way. It lies north of Jerusalem on the road from Jerusalem to Shechem on the east side of the highway, near the Valley of Livona, just south of the Valley of Livona. This is what it says in the Bible. And it wasn't very difficult, therefore, for the archaeologists to find Shiloh. But the road still goes the same route. The Valley of Livona is still called the Valley of Livona. And they looked east of the highway in that vicinity between Jerusalem and Shechem, and they very quickly found it on the east side of the highway. So sometimes general geographic features will do it. And anyone that ignores that information in assigning a name to a place does so at his own peril. Okay, you found your particular place. You now want to continue with your method. You want to actually dig things up. Well, this is an area where archaeology has matured considerably. In the early days, they just sort of dug anywhere. And actually, they were more interested in pulling out good-looking specimens from the ground, statues, columns, jewelry, other precious things, and they weren't really learning about ancient societies. But even when they began to be interested in trying to understand these ancient societies better, they still, for quite some time, engaged in a lot of aimless digging over the site. Then they advanced to a specific method, which is called the trench method. If you have a hill, very simply, you just dig a trench all the way down the side of the hill through every layer of the site. You cut it through like you would cut through a layer cake and take out a piece. That lets you sample all the different layers. Now, what's the weakness of this type of method? Is that it'd be great if the layers of the tell were arranged just like the layers of a seven-layer cake. You would indeed sample every layer. But the problem is that they're not that way. Some layers don't go across the whole tell. They may not be present in your trench. And so therefore, other methods had to be devised. Today, they use a system which is called the Wheeler-Kenyon method. The Kenyon part of that name is from Dame Kathleen Kenyon, who did a great deal to advance biblical archaeology in terms of methodology. And it is shown here in the next slide. Sorry, the one after this. This just shows you some of the tools. You take your site and you take selected portions of your site and you divide it up into squares, usually 5 meters on a side. And you can see the little boxes there denote the positions of the grid that was laid out on the ground before they started digging. And then even when you find things, you leave the wall separating the square, or at least a large part of it. See here, a part of the wall has been taken down so they could see the ancient wall and how it related to other sections of it. But you maintain this grid because this enables you to pinpoint the position of anything you find, because you have a grid laid out on your contour map of the site and you can pinpoint the position of anything that you happen to find. Now, you don't dig the whole site. Takes too long, costs too much. At least today, people don't even try to. In the 1930s, there was an ambitious team from the University of Chicago, I think it was, that went out to Megiddo and said, we're going to dig this whole site from top to bottom and side to side. Well, it is still the most excavated site in the entire country. But I think it's something like about 2 or 4% has been dug of the whole possibility. It's just too much material. You can't do it. Plus, they're wise enough now to realize it's better not to. Leave something for other people who might come along with better methods, you see. And they can check your work and correct it if need be. But this is the current method. You divide your area up that you are going to dig with a grid, usually 5 meters on a side. There's no cardinal rule that says it must be exactly 5 meters on a side. It's just become sort of a convention. And then you proceed. In this next slide, you see how in certain places they've removed the walls that are left so they could see more clearly the architectural remains. In the upper squares, you can still see the grid barrier walls. Next. Here you see the different layers. You also see a student and a former student. Craig Minke, I think he's up there in the office in Vancouver. And this is somebody who is in our class. Okay. You have the different layers in this section. And you can see sometimes how chock full of pottery a layer can be. This is not rock. This is pottery. All compacted together in that particular layer. And it's very important to be able to read these layers so that you can recheck what you've dug through. That's why, another reason you leave these walls. Next, please. Frequently, it's not a cardinal rule, but frequently, when you're digging down in your square, you might dig one section, small part of your square, to a lower depth. This is called a probe trench. A probe trench, because you're probing to see what might be underneath. That'll tell you whether you can go down fast or you should go down slowly. Next, please. Here you see the end of a probe trench, and you can see barely, slightly beneath the surface, the remains of a lot of rocks, probably a wall. This told them, okay, let's not go too fast here. Let's go down, but go down slowly. There's probably something here to discover. So this is one reason why you dig a probe trench. Okay, next. Here you see people digging up the earth, putting them in buckets, loading the buckets into wheelbarrows. Sometimes you can't get the wheelbarrows in close enough, so you have to pass them hand to hand. Occasionally, when you're working some rich material, you will have to sift every bucketful to find small objects. I remember on the dig in Jerusalem, I began finding a whole bunch of coins, gold coins and silver coins. And when I reported it very gleefully, I almost immediately felt bad because the whole mountain of dirt we'd moved for the past few days, we had to go back and sift it again. We did find a lot more coins, though. Next. Measurements must be taken. Detailed measurements of positions when objects of importance are found. Next. That was Mary Lynn Mincy. I don't know if any of you know her, former Big Sandy grad. Here again, you see the measuring process being taken. They're measuring from the depth and position away from the side wall of the square to get the exact position. Next. Records are kept daily, usually, of what has happened in an individual square. Drawings are made of walls and other architectural features, exactly to scale. You see, you're engaged in systematic destruction as you go down. As you go down, you destroy completely usually what you've gone through. This will be the only record of what you found, so it better be accurate. Photographs are taken of particularly interesting finds. You see this little meter stick to give scale. Then the specimens are preserved for analysis. And now we've come to the analysis part, which is very scientific, very detailed measurements made of pottery, very detailed drawings made from all different views. And then these are compared to known samples. We'll understand why a little later. Now we come to the most difficult area of archaeological method, interpretation. This is where you move from mostly science to mostly art. Written documents are invaluable. You notice how these were found thousands of years afterwards, 5,000 years after they were written, but they were still readable. They could be recovered, even though this place had been burned. Next. You have to be able to understand the values and the motives of ancient peoples. Written documents tell you these things best. Written documents tell you about values and motives of people. Here you have the Cyrus cylinder, where he gave a decree similar to the one we find in Ezra 1, verses 1 through 7, I think it is, allowing the Jews to return. This is not that decree, but it's a similar one. It gives you an idea of the motive behind the one we read in the Bible. Next. Many ancient languages had to be decoded. As with the Rosetta Stone, it gave us the key to the Egyptian language. This inscription carved on this rock face, the man who copied it had to let himself down in a sling and copy this thing laboriously, unlocked the ancient cuneiform script of Mesopotamia. What do you do when you don't have written records? You make inferences. Sometimes they can be very easy. Which is older, this rough structure in the corner or the mosaic? Simple, right? Isn't it? Which is older? Which came first? Which came second? Since the rough structure obliterates part of the mosaic, obviously the mosaic is earlier, you see. That's simple. This is part of Herod's palace near Jericho. What kind of architecture did Herod like? Simple. You take this remains, you compare it to others, and you find it's just like a typical Roman villa. So he liked Roman architecture. You can make an estimation of his tastes, you see. This type of brickwork called opus reticulum is unique to Italy, the Italian method of construction. But this is in Herod's palace near Jericho. How did it get here? Now, this becomes less certain. Did he send craftsmen to Italy to learn the technique? Did he bring craftsmen from Italy to do it who knew the technique? Which one? No written record, no way to know. You can't reduce it to more than an either-or situation. Three gates, very similar in design, all from the same general period. That's all you could say about it. All from the same general period, all very similar in design, all from the 10th century B.C. Who built them? You have to make a bit of a leap. The Bible says in 1 Kings 9:15 that Solomon, who lived in the 10th century, built a fortress at Gezer, Hazor, and Megiddo. Right time period, same man building exactly these three cities, same plan for the gateway, ergo probably, note the word, probably Solomon responsible for all three. And you're not as certain this time as we were with the first inference. We're getting less and less certain with our inferences, you see, because we don't have written records for it. The Bible might not, it says he built it, but we don't know if this is the remains of what he built. We could be missing his remains, you see. Have to be careful. Next one. Oh, skip this one. Finally, you come down to something like this. What is it? What's its purpose? Dovecote? Carrier pigeon thing? Mailboxes, storage cabinets for personal possessions, places where you took the cremated remains of people and put them in these niches. You can't be certain. The conventional answer is that they were dovecotes, you know, for doves using as carrier pigeons type things. Not dovecotes, but I guess they use them for carrier pigeons, I guess you'd say, for messages. Okay, we'll finish up. We'll see you next time.